from Bucks Pocket to the shores of Orange Beach and all points in between. An insider's perspective on Alabama politics. It's the Jeff Poor Show.
I don't think Hank done it this way. No.
Hey, welcome to the Jeff Poor Show on FM Talk 106.5. Happy Friday morning to you. Thank you. Thank you so much for listening. We always appreciate you tuning in. Jam-packed show planned for you today. Coming up here in just a matter of moments, United States Senator Tommy Tuberville waiting on the line to talk to us. We also got Mobile Mayor Sandy Stimson announced his reelection bid. He's coming up here at the bottom of the hour. In the next hour, our good friend, State Senator Chris Elliott from over at Daphne, we're going to talk to him. Budget hearings underway up in Montgomery. And we'll close it out at 11 o'clock out. April Marie Fogle of Alabama Today, our usual Friday guest. And the new majority leader, I guess you would call him the state Senate majority leader designate, Clay Schofield from Gunnersville, got to talk to us about leadership in the Alabama Senate. So all that and more, please stick around. 251-343-0106 if you want to weigh in. Preferably hit the text line up. We will be fielding your queries throughout the program. Joining us now, as I mentioned, very happy to introduce my next guest. Spending time in Washington, D.C., very tough place to be these days. Senator Tommy Tuberville is on the line. Senator, how are you this morning?
I'm doing great, Jeff. And by the way, congratulations. Your life has changed with the little one coming on, so congratulations.
I appreciate it. That's not, that is by no means an understatement. It has, It has really, 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 really changed. But I do appreciate it. Well, let's kick it off here. We were talking a little off air. For the listeners, some have probably spent some time in D.C. over the years, but right now, when you're up there, and everything is kind of shut down right there around the Capitol Hill. Talk a little bit about what that looks like right now.
Understatement, shut down. I live about 100 yards from my office. I actually bought a house next to Mitch McConnell, having a lot of it reworked. It's only a little over 1,000 square feet, so that's kind of a small place, but that's all you need. But it's a war zone. I never seen anything like it. My dad was in military forever and National Guard, and we've had 25,000 National Guard people there for, I guess, now going on 3 weeks. I think we're down maybe under 10,000 now, but we have 20 miles of razor wire fence all the way around all the buildings, Capitol, the Senate buildings, and these guys and girls have been sleeping outside my office on the floor. You know, we'd take candy out to them, popcorn, and they've been eating MREs. It's a shame. They were treated badly. Not that they were abused or anything. It's just there was no planning on how you gonna sleep that many people. And they're walking around with M5s and M16s, and it is very different. I talked to the Alabama troops that were up there. We took pictures and ran into a lot of them. Every time I'd walk by National Guard, hey, where are you from? I'm from Tennessee. Where are you from? You know, we had troops from all 50 states. We spent millions of the taxpayer's dollar on this. And this, I guess this came from Nancy Pelosi, because she dropped the ball on, she's the head of security for the Capitol. And of course, she ain't gonna take any blame for anything, but, they're all there. And I think they're going to stay probably through the, State of the Union address, but they don't need to be there. I mean, Capitol Police obviously were overwhelmed. Unfortunately, that was a tragedy of what happened. And a lot of conservative Republicans were involved in this. And that was wrong. It put the Republican Party, set us back a good ways for what happened here. I don't know who else was involved, but they had no business coming in that Capitol. That was my first day on the floor. And Jeff, I'm sitting there watching this. And of course, Vice President Pence was leading the Senate. We're on the vote for confirming President Biden. And all of a sudden, about 7 or 8 guys run in and grab the vice president and drag him out. And, you know, I'm kind of looking around going, you know, my first day here, that don't look right. And all of a sudden you started hearing gunshots. Or whatever it was big claps, maybe tear gas or whatever, people screaming and hollering. And then they told us that the Capitol had been breached and they got us out of there. We never saw anybody. They got us out. We went to a bunker for 5 hours and gave me a chance to meet a lot of the other senators. We was all together in a small place. So unfortunately, that happened. And that it was dead wrong. People are going to go to jail and should go to jail for what they did, breaking windows in our nation's house and putting people in harm's way. One girl lost her life as she got shot, and one Capitol policeman got hit in the head with a fire extinguisher. And then you had a couple that had heart attacks, and that really disappointed me in how the people handle that. But it's what it is, and it's kind of like in a football game. We fumbled three or four times in a row there as Republicans, and now we got to fight back because they're using it against us every day with all these troops and the razor wire. And, you know, Republicans are bad, and, you know, we want to take over the world. I mean, it's just, but we'll come back. We just got to keep a positive attitude and work for the people of this country.
Coach, let's move on. Maybe a little bit happier note here. You're working with your colleagues, two across the aisle, Senator Shelby here in Alabama, and John Ossoff, Raphael Warnock, the two U.S. senators from Georgia now, a resolution to honor Hank Aaron. Speak on that, if you would.
Yeah, Hank was born in Mobile. Most people probably know that. He moved around. But I can remember like yesterday when he hit that home run and ran around the bases and people grabbing at him and all that. And of course, that would never happen today with all the security. But we need, you know, I was the two new senators from Georgia called and asked if I'd get aboard, and we did. And we made a resolution to honor him, his life, and Senator Shelby. And I think it's great. I really do. And of course, he's a big part of the history of sports, and just glad we could do that.
Yeah, glad he's being recognized in that arena as well. Some other things. Let's the Biden administration executive order, and I know they've come fast and furious here in his first week or and a half or so being in office. But the one I think that's got a lot of attention down here, particularly, is deals with energy. Extraction of energy, Keystone Pipeline, things of that nature. It's just going to have a broad impact on the population.
A huge impact. But he told everybody. And the people that voted for him knew that this was going to happen. And just always remember, you know, you're going to get what you vote for. And so, Cindy Loomis, I've co-sponsored a bill with her for trying to get back leases for federal land. For energy and minerals. And so we put that one up, and Cindy's a good friend. She's going in with me, and I think that was awesome. But folks, you're getting ready to see prices jump. They are coming after oil. They're coming after coal. They're coming after anything other than wind and solar. And then they're going to put billions into that, which last time we all figured out, Solyndra, all those folks went bankrupt. They lost billions of taxpayers' dollars. And climate change is number one on the list. It ought to be the pandemic. But for some reason there, you know, they want to save the world. And, you know, we're all in for climate change. We're all making things better every day. But this energy bill that they're pushing through is going to be a detriment to everybody. And because we're going to have to lean on Saudi Arabia, Iran, you know, the AIPAC again. And so it's just unfortunate.
Coach, something else, I guess this is kind of overshadowing everything going on in Washington, D.C., is this impeachment of Trump, and he's out of office, and there's these constitutional questions. You, 44 of your other Republican colleagues voted against impeachment. Speak on where you are on impeachment right now.
Yeah, that's not going to pass. They just ran this through. They hate Donald Trump, and they're trying to embarrass him. They think they can keep him from running for president again, but that's not going to happen. They didn't have any witnesses, no due process in the House. They just ran it through in 53 hours, which is a record even for these Democrats. And so they brought the articles down, and Rand Paul did a good job of bringing it up. Said, hey, we can't impeach a citizen. I mean, this guy's not president. That's not in the Constitution. We voted on it 45-55, which shows you that, you know, they got to have 67 votes. But February the 8th or 9th, whenever that is, we're going to sit there and listen to them and go through this debacle when we need to be working on the pandemic, getting money to the small businesses, people that need money. It's like anything else. It seems like we're doing something on something else when we got a lot of other things to help the taxpayers and the citizens of this country. But we dropped the ball. You know, I'm you know, I'm not surprised because of their hatred for Donald Trump, but they're going to do anything they possibly can, but they're going to fail on this. But we're going to waste 2 weeks of trying to help the American people, you know, get back on their feet from this pandemic.
Yeah, and I don't know if you're fully aware, but I would have to think a new president, first 100 days, is going to be very, very ambitious. But it sounds like, you know, going into February, you're going to lose, if you're the Biden administration, they're going to lose a lot of ground dealing with impeachment instead of whatever left of center policies they're trying to promote.
Yeah, I went to the inauguration. I sat in front of him. Tucker, my son, went, and we sat by Christopher Wray, FBI director, John Kerry, who's, I think he's running the country, to be honest with you. You know, he's supposedly the climate change guru, but him and Biden are real close. You know, these executive orders now, he's leading with an ink pen is all he's doing. He's playing king. And so, he's done 5 times more than Barack Obama in the first week and Trump did, in there for 5 times. And he's probably going to get close to 50, which is ridiculous because he's just bypassing us. But he's got the House and the Senate. He's got everything at his disposal. And if you don't put it as a law and you make an executive order, the next president is going to change it back. But he's putting a lot of people in harm's way with immigration, stopping the wall. You know, when I wrote an op-ed yesterday in Washington, one of the newspapers, Examiner, Washington Examiner, about women, sports. You know, it's done better than any time ever because of interest. And now he's going to allow young boys to shower, dress, and play in women's sports. And you're talking about a game changer now. You're going to have young girls that's not going to get in athletics because of that. And I do not understand that whatsoever. There's a lot of things I don't understand about what they're doing, but we're going to fight, you know. They change in the rules very quickly. We just got to make sure we stay up with it and stay on top of it and keep fighting for the American people and the people of Alabama.
Joined by Senator Tommy Tuberville here on the program. Got a couple more minutes with him here before we have to let him go. Coach, I know this is a very important issue to a lot of people around the state. It's the abortion issue. I guess you're taking some steps to kind of get in front of it, the taxpayer funding aspect of it, and obviously the thing that's always kind of on the docket in these legislative bodies, taking a pain-capable abortion approach to legislation. Talk about your efforts on that front.
Well, Senator Graham, and I'm co-sponsoring it, has come up with a law it's the Pain Capable Unborn Child Protection Act, and basically says after 20 weeks, you're done. Can't think about it. Of course, you shouldn't do it even before that, but we're trying to get to a point where, they're not having abortion for kids that's pretty much already, formed in the womb. So that's one of them. And hey, they love abortion. There's not a handful of Christians on that side. You can't be a Christian. Joe Biden, I don't know where he's coming from. He says he's a Christian, but he's for killing millions of babies every year. But he does that to get elected. That's what these guys like Joe Biden, career politicians, they just say what they want people to hear on that side to get votes. But I'll tell you what, this abortion thing, Senator Wicker is coming up with, I co-sponsored a bill with him. Also, he's from Mississippi, not giving taxpayers money to people for abortion. I help co-sponsor that. That'll be a good bill. But again, we're just trying to put things out there where hopefully something will stick. But again, you know, the people of this country voted for Joe Biden and voted for 50 senators from the Democratic side. They got control. They control the House. And like I said, we have got to do our homework. We got to fight like heck. And, people got to understand where we're at, and we are not going to just stand there and take it. It's not going to happen. We're going to fight back every day to try to make this country, this state, and this country better.
Coach, got to leave it there, but we appreciate it. Stay safe up there in D.C. And all points in between, and we'll do this again real soon.
Everybody take their vaccine. I took mine, my last one yesterday. Take your vaccine, folks. I want to go to football and basketball in person next year. I don't want to watch it on TV. Let's take our vaccine. Thank you. Thank you, Jeff.
Well said. Thanks for coming on, Coach. United States Senator Tommy Tuberville. We got to get a break in here. We'll be right back. This is FM Talk 106.5.
Oh, mama, can this really be the end? To be stuck inside a mobile with the Memphis Blues again.
Welcome back to the Jeff Porch Show at FM Talk 106.5. Happy Friday morning to you. Still to come here in just a few minutes. We'll talk to Mobile Mayor Sandy Simpson. A lot going on the city front, in particular with this mayoral election heating up here. I know it's just barely the end of January, and we're going into August with that. But that is these off year cycles. That's going to be the big story, I think, throughout 2021. As we head into the next year, which will be really, really pick up with potentially a gubernatorial and U.S. Senate elections on the front. But that will start kicking up here very shortly. But that is something we are going to keep an eye on. Also on the program, say Senator Chris Elliott, the guys up in Montgomery are getting back together. The big thing up there to me, big thing up there is relative because it's overshadowed by everything going on in Washington, D.C. It really is the prison situation. And I talked to a few lawmakers this week about that. Budget hearings, Jeff Dunn and Cam Ward appearing before the budget committee. It's a joint session there. And we have on this table the lease bill prison plan from the governor, but we don't really have any details. Yet there is this, I don't know, it seems to be okay with a lot of people, but to me, just kind of at face value, looking at it from the outside in, the governor's going to want $88 million a year for a lease plan, and we don't really have any details. The legislature can do what the legislature is going to do, but the public should be entitled to the details of something of an expenditure that big as well. It's just we're told it's a threat to the negotiating, to the tactics they're using. That if this is dealt with in the public, if this is dealt with over the airwaves, over the television or wherever the news media, that it'll sour the deal and the state could lose millions or could lose leverage in the deal. Isn't that the same approach they took with the toll bridge? And something else, guys. I'm not convinced that toll bridge issue is totally dormant right now. I think there's still some discussions going on behind the scenes about where that will proceed. But transparency in government needs to you always want to side on transparency. State government, it just seems like we're willing to play fast and loose with that at the executive level. Let's hope with the legislature back that we'll get some more transparency, but there doesn't seem to be a lot of willingness with the Ivy administration to really talk about what they're doing with the regards to the prison situation. So we're keeping an eye on that. Obviously, there's a lot of other things going on, the vaccinations. And the story's cooled off a little bit. But over the last 2 weeks, just a lot of the public sour on how Alabama had rolled out the vaccine for COVID-19. The phone line that was busy, there was no the supply and what you were hearing from the Alabama Department of Public Health sometimes would contradict itself. Wonder if that situation is resolving itself somewhat. And we've heard this over and over again, really what the hiccup is these guys they don't have enough vaccine to distribute. So until they get more vaccine, they're going to have to, I don't know, they got to deal with these problems. I would argue put a better face on for the public. More of that and more, 251-343-0106. Going to get a break here. We'll be right back. This is FM Talk 106.5.
Country. first beer. It's where I found Jesus, where I wrecked my first car. I tore it all to pieces.
And welcome back to the Jeff Porsche Show on FM Talk 106.5. Happy Friday morning to you. Hope everyone is doing well. Still to come on the program, State Senator Chris Elliott. He'll join us in the next hour. Also, April Marie Fogle, Alabama Today, and the soon-to-be State Senate Majority Leader, Clay Schofield, joining us in the 11 o'clock hour as well. So please stick around for that. Very pleased to bring on my next guest. He's been the mayor of Mobile now for several years, but good to hear from him. I believe this is the first time he's been on with me in my capacity as a Mobile radio host, so I'm very excited. Mobile Mayor Sandy Stimson is on the line. Mayor, how are you this morning?
Doing great, Jeff. Hope you're doing well.
Doing well. Thank you for making time for us. We always appreciate it. Let's get right into it. First up, it's now official. You're running for re-election. Talk about what led you to that decision.
Well, first I'll say that I'm really excited about it, Jeff. We've accomplished a lot over the last several years, but just because things don't move quite as fast in the public sector as they do in the private sector, I realize that it's going to take four more years to bring a lot of these projects to completion or really get them going in the right direction. And so it's really a sense of duty to do that. Since we started them, I feel an obligation to continue to carry the banner to make sure it happens.
Well, a couple of those things. I've heard you mention moving the airport from Batesville back to Brooklee seems to be one of the big ones. Give us kind of an idea of where that is, the process, what's involved, and what you're having to do to make it happen.
So is that on the Brooklee project specifically?
Yeah, just getting commercial air traffic from Batesville to back to Brooklee.
Yeah. So, you know, what you got, Jeff, is that the airport authority, really is kind of the quarterback of that, because there's so much work has to be done with the FAA, in order to do it. They have completed their master plan. They're putting the final, finessing touches on it. But they're working in conjunction really with the city, and to the much larger degree in the past, the port also, but to make sure that this move is going to, be the correct thing, that we do the correct things that will last really for decades to come. And so our role in it is kind of a supporting role, a convening role, and trying to make sure that the citizens understand the benefits that will accrue from this.
Yeah, that seems to be one of the vulnerabilities. It's just getting downtown to the out to West Mobile to the airport. But I mean, do you think it would be a quality of life improvement just to get the proximity or the distance short between the center of the city to the airport?
Absolutely. Studies have shown that if we will move the airport, that we will increase the number of passengers riding, traveling out of that airport. With increased travelers, you could have more direct flights, you could have cheaper fares, have more commerce. There's nothing that we have seen that points to something being negative about it. It's a win-win because of the collaboration and the things that can happen between the port and the airport. So it's a matter of, finding the funding sources, making sure the plans have got the proper buy-in and that we get it right. But I believe that we're well on our way to doing all those things. So it's a huge game changer for the city of Mobile.
Something else you're working on, and well, I think this has been the story of the last couple of years here, is finally getting a reasonable way to cross Mobile Bay from Mobile into Baldwin County and vice versa, and it seems to be ongoing and going. What are you hearing? Where do you think we are on getting back that project, the ball rolling back on that?
Well, as you know, because you've interviewed a lot of the political leaders and others that have talked about conversations that have been ongoing about what is it going to take to get it back on everybody's agenda, to get the governor and ALDOT reengaged, you know, working with the Mobile County and the Eastern Shore MPO to come up with a plan that is acceptable to the citizens, you know, and to the community in general. And so those conversations have been going on, but there's no engineering drawings that, you know, this is conceptual at this point in time. But we have got to do something to move this project forward because there's so much is at stake, you know, and really it's a congestion problem. And when you find that either our trucks that are carrying the commerce or in our citizens are locked down in traffic and it's congested, I mean, that is slowing down our economy. I mean, congested economy. And I'll give you a specific example. This is a small thing to some people, but every day downtown Mobile is in gridlock in the area of the Bankhead Tunnel and Water Street because of the congestion, you know, going through the tunnel. So those merchants in downtown Mobile, you know, there's a time of day because they can't do business because there's gridlock. But it's much worse than that in so many areas.
Right. I guess, you know, the experience of 2019 and dealing with it, do you worry about there being kind of an effect there that soured the public on some of this or maybe a mistrust? We've had elected officials come on and say they don't trust this governor, but not so much that, but the public and getting the public on board on an idea, which I think is probably one of the biggest parts of it.
Let me make a comment about that. This project is transcendent. They've been going on for 20 years. I think I was the chairman of the Chamber of Commerce in maybe 2010. And I started participating in groups going to D.C. About this project back then, talking to DOT and FHWA, talking to the senator's office. You know, ALDOT has been engaged in this since before Governor Ivey. And so obviously when you have a controversial subject, people can make it a hot potato. And I think there's undue criticism that's been thrown at Governor Ivey about this. She recognizes the need for this, but she also recognizes that the Southwest Alabama has to get their act together, in order to make this happen. And so it's really incumbent upon the two MPOs, because that's where it came to a screeching halt last time. It's incumbent upon the two MPOs to get together, work with ALDOT and come up with a feasible plan that's acceptable. You know, and part of that feasible plan is that needs to be a no-toll situation. The legacy part of this, you know, the legacy, the Wallace Tunnels, the Bankhead Tunnel, the Africatown Cochran Bridge. You know, people are expecting there to be no toll on those thoroughfares. And, you know, we need to come up with a plan that embraces that.
Joined by Mobile Mayor Sandy Stimson here on the program. Mayor, something, I guess, a more pleasant note. The efforts to honor Hank Aaron, Mobile with its baseball history, you know, there's countless names, but Hank Aaron sort of leads the way. Talk about what you got in the works.
Jeff, that is one of the things that we're working on that I think almost has universal support. Everybody realizes that we need to do something to honor Hank Aaron. Yes, we've named the stadium after him, but we have four other Cooperstown Baseball Hall of Famers, and we've never come up with the right idea to really showcase them. And so the idea that we have of Hall of Fame Courtyard, which would be at the very foot of Government Street, I mean, actually on the sidewalk where the convention center is, where Government Street intersects Water Street, you know, it will be a gateway. This courtyard will be a gateway to the riverfront. And also for those that are riding down Water Street, are getting ready to turn from Government Street, they'll be looking at these life-size bronze statues of these baseball iconic heroes. And there will be a curiosity element there, and we hope it's going to be a magnet to draw not just Mobilians there, but our visitors there. And there'll be a build out. I'm sure this is going to be, it's already created a lot of excitement about, you know, can we do maybe a football Hall of Fame in conjunction with this? And can we honor some of our other sports heroes? Because Mobile Sports Hall of Fame has, you know, just hundreds of sports heroes. So I'm real excited about being able to get this done and get it done in the next, you know, couple of years, actually. So I think we'll see a lot of support for it.
Do you think that we'll see a day, and I don't know, I haven't heard much about it, that minor league baseball could come back to Mobile?
You're saying, do I think I'll see the day when...
Do you think we'll see a time here soon that we'll see minor league baseball return to Mobile?
You know, there's such a speed change going on in baseball between the major leagues and the minor leagues with reducing the number of teams. You know, it'd be really speculation at best for me to say whether we'll have a minor league baseball team. I'll tell you, I'm excited about the upcoming event we have with the Savannah Bananas, you know, which I don't know if you're familiar with that, but they are somewhat like the Harvard Globetrotters. But the Globetrotters are to basketball. The Savannah Bananas are to baseball. They'll be here. I think they're going to probably do two nights. And I think that Mobilians that have the opportunity to attend are going to be really surprised at what they see. And, of course, what we would love to do, we would love to convince the Savannah Bananas that they need to have another home location, and it needs to be not only Savannah, Georgia, but it needs to be Mobile, Alabama. So we're putting our best foot forward to convince them that there's a future for them in Mobile, because, you know, this, Jeff, there's two pieces of this. Some of them, the baseball people that just, you know, live and breathe baseball. But there are others that are looking for entertainment. And so the entertainment part of this, if it can come through the Savannah Bananas, you know, you will see at least my administration really support and push this.
And lastly here, Mayor, we had one of your opponents on yesterday, kind of talked about crime in Mobile and curbing that. The numbers are what they are. In another term, is there things you could do differently? You're always striving toward a goal of obviously no crime, but you know, is there things that we need to be looking at and maybe taking a different approach when it comes to curbing crime in the city of Mobile?
So, Jeff, the answer to that is yes, from a different approach, and really it's an add-on to what you're doing. I mean, you've got to build on the things that you're doing, but so much of it has to be community-based, because it's impossible for the police to know that a domestic violence situation is getting ready to happen, you know, without the community alerting them. And then really, to a degree, there's limitations on what the police can do, even when they are limited to that. But we are working on some initiatives right now that hopefully will broaden the input that we get from the community so that they can help be part of the solution. We've said for, you know, the last 8 years, you really can't arrest your way out of this. But there's some things that we're working on also in the affordable housing area, that if we can get that done so we get rid of some of the blighted properties, it is not a rifle shot approach. There are multiple things that have to go on simultaneously, you know, in order to reduce the crime. I think across America, generally speaking, in cities the size of Mobile, you've seen an upsweep in crime all across the country. And, you know, Mobile is not in a silo on that. One thing that does differentiate Mobile from a lot of others, we probably have the highest solve rate up to crime of anybody our size, and even in some cases, cities smaller than us. So our police department, when it comes to the policing aspect, post-crime, if we can get the criminals off the street and keep them off the street, it helps. So we are good at that, but, you know, there are other things that have got to happen to complement that, such as just the judicial system. But we work with them also.
And we'll wrap it up on this, Mayor. This is kind of tangentially related to the crime question, but COVID and the resources, obviously you had to deal with it with law enforcement and getting reimbursed by the state. How are things going on that front, dealing with the pandemic, all at the same time trying to keep all the functions of city government underway?
So that is a broad question, you know, Jeff, but what we've done, the city, in working collaboration with USA Health, I've had people from the outside tell us it is the gold standard. It is the model that other cities should be following, because we have partnered with South Alabama. It took us a while to get started, but with the testing facility that we have in the Civic Center, and now the testing and the vaccination partnership that we have with them, that's not happening as far as a partnership with the city and a hospital in very many places to the degree it is in Mobile. I know recently we were talking about the opportunity to help the school system vaccinate all the school teachers. And we believe that in conversations that continues to go on, and if we can get the vaccine, you know, we have a plan where we could vaccinate. We believe we could vaccinate all of our teachers over a weekend if we can get the vaccine. No, but so when it comes to COVID, there is no playbook. You know, everything that we're doing is trying to be, we're taking ideas from anybody that gives them, and we're trying to work those so that we can build upon the partnerships that already exist so that we can protect the citizens. And right now, the protection part of it is more focused on the vaccine, but we continue to send the message out about, you know, the good hygiene and the mask wearing. So yes, this caused a lot of new challenges in 2020, but we've learned a lot. And in 2021, we'll be better at this game than we were in 2020.
Mayor, we got to leave it there, but I appreciate you coming on. Hopefully we can do it again real soon.
Hey, you just call. We're on standby.
All right. Well, thank you for your leadership, and we'll talk again. That was Mobile Mayor Sandy Stimson, ladies and gentlemen. We got to get a break in here. We'll be right back. This is FM Talk 106.5. Welcome back to the Jeff Porch Show on FM Talk 106.5. Thank you for listening. A little bit of a schedule change here. We're going to talk to April Marie Fogle of Alabama today in the next segment. She's spending a little bit of time up in Montgomery and asked to be moved around. Well, we'll hear from her in the next hour almost immediately. Also, we'll hear from State Senator Chris Elliott. We'll talk to him about what's going on in Montgomery, and we will wrap it all up with Clay Schofield, who will soon be the state Senate Majority Leader. He is filling the void left behind by Greg Reed of Walker County, who will soon be the new president of the Alabama Senate. We have him on the docket next week to talk to after he is sworn in. But so we're going to take a big look at get all the heavy hitters in with the legislature to come on and talk about it. Speaker Mac McCutcheon, Speaker of the House, will be with us on Monday. But a lot to look forward to, and you'll get the best coverage on radio there is out there of Alabama politics. I'll assure you that, or at least the best effort. I don't know. I guess that is subjective. Anyway, make sure you stick around, tune in for all of that. We'll make sure we have all our bases covered. Interesting things going on right now. Looks like there's still some talk about just how far the Biden administration's going to go with some of the COVID-19 measures, some of the restrictions. Already talking. I guess this is what we were kind of fearful of, the vaccine. You're going to have had the vaccine to go do anything. You have to show your papers, domestic travel. If you want to fly from Mobile to Atlanta on a Delta flight, are you going to have a COVID test? Not now that you have to go through TSA and take everything out of your pockets and your shoes off. You also got to be checked for a infectious virus. So just add that to the list of your day if you travel or for business or wherever. All right, we'll be right back. This is FM Talk 1065.
So I think what I'm concerned about is we already have so few individuals who are engaged with the Capitol. Every session you come down, you see the same people. Maybe they come for their association weeks, or they come with their, you know, there used to be these Tea Party groups, but there's still several iterations of them around, the Common Sense Campaign being one of them, and then the Legislative Watchdogs out of Birmingham being another. I do not want a legislative session. It kills me. We're going to have a session that does not include these individuals. They're going to allow some press into the State House building, but they're not going to allow these groups in. And I worry about the impact of that. So I'm here kind of asking questions and looking at what a digital session looks like. I'm worried because I'm not feeling good about it.
Well, some of it's gone. It seems like it's gone okay, but tell me, you know, the governor could barely get her press conferences streamed properly with proper, you know, the audio or video or whatever. The legislature seems to have been doing okay at this, but I don't know. We don't exactly have a good track record to really be excited about when it comes to government and government bureaucracy trying their hand at new technology to make things more available to the public.
Well, you got to keep in mind this State House, and you know, there was a big brouhaha when the Senate tried to use COVID funds to get themselves a new State House. Remember?
Right. Yeah.
They suggested it. It was just an offhanded, maybe kind of sort of. No, the fact of the matter is the state of Alabama needs a new place for the legislature to meet, period. I am a small government, fiscally conservative Republican, and I'm telling you the State House is awful. And it's awful in a way that impedes the citizens from being active in the political process, in the legislative process, and getting to know their members. And so one of the things about the State House is that the technology is awful. And thankfully, there's been a lot of lead time for them to get ready. And I understand that they have been trying to increase their internet capacity, and they've been practicing live streaming and that sort of thing. And I'm glad for it. But the building is so old, and the infrastructure being, meaning every part of the building, from the wiring to the internet to the whatever, is so bad and so old that I do think there's going to be, you know, there's going to be more kinks in the system than there would be if we had a newer building. So I know it was a bad time, so kind of is a bad time to talk about funding for a new building, but I'm telling you, for the participation of ordinary citizens, we need it. We need a safer, better, more technologically advanced building for our legislative session.
Well, I tell you, it's fascinating, too, though, the how they wound up from going from the state capitol over there to that old highway building on Union Street. That was supposed to be a temporary thing.
I was going to say, it was never meant to be permanent, and it has clearly become that, and it's awful.
Yeah.
You've been there.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's mold, there's leaks, random fires, and you just, it's hard to, you know, I get it if you don't think that the legislature should be spending taxpayer money on something like a grand new state house. I completely understand that. But what's interesting, though, is if you are really the constitutional three branches of government type of advocate, conservative, you got to have three co-equals of government. And I think in some ways that State House is preventing the legislature from being a co-equal branch of government. And it's allowed the executive to kind of fill a vacuum, if you will, with the, you know, the power, the balance of power in Montgomery.
No, I have not thought of it that way, but you're absolutely right. There is something to be said for the way, you know, the way you treat, others, right? Or the way that you look down or whatever others. And it is certainly, it is certainly as if the legislature is the stepchild of the state. And again, mold, we're talking, for those who haven't, aren't familiar with this, this is a building that's mold infected. The people who work there throughout the year have had health concerns about this. It's not kept well. There's not good air circulation. It's truly problematic, and it's not indicative of a place where, again, people are going to want to drive all and then spend all day there under, you know, cramped quarters in bad conditions.
No, and you know, there are just a number of problems. Even the people that work there on a daily basis, here's just something that could potentially impact our threatened state. The state is, if you're a staffer there and you're exposed to some of the elements, the asbestos, the mold, I would think you've got to be a little worried if you're anybody in state government about these people falling ill and perhaps suing the state of Alabama.
Every time I step foot into the state house, I say the same thing. I have the utmost respect for the people who go to work there every day, because it's just not, it's not a good working environment. And that to say, I say that meaning, it's all around bad. And here's the other thing. And I know this is hokey. This is a political show, which I'm usually hard hitting and giving people a hard time. But nobody wants to, you know, how discouraging is it to go to a building that is run down? But back to the point of this whole, what started this whole thing is I don't know. I think they're as ready as they can be given what they've got, but I think this is a good springboard for talking about getting better.
Yeah. It ought to get better, but I don't know at face value, the way people in this state are, there just doesn't seem to be the political will or any effort to really sell it. And I will tell you, to make the state house better, well, what Governor Ivey did with the CARES Act thing to kind of wrestle control of the CARES Act money, I think that probably set back for building a new state house or any effort at least 5 years.
You could be right. The power struggle between the legislature and the governor is going to be an interesting thing to watch this session, because you've got a whole group of people who want to come in, and that's their priority for the session. People come up here with an agenda each and every legislative session, and there's a number of people coming up here with an agenda of reining in the emergency powers that the governor and the Department of Health have.
Well, and that's, you know, right now the governor's winning all the battles, but I think you're right. I'm legitimately interested to see how far those efforts go. I know Senator Whatley wants to roll some of it back, but the word on the street was always the reason we never had a special session to deal with ASCO, to deal with anything, not just this. But the governor was fearful of the legislature, somebody getting a bill to the floor and then another bill to the floor. And obviously it's so easy to override a veto in the Alabama legislature that it was going to curb some of that authority. And she didn't want the legislature really meddling in what she thought is the right thing to do with dealing with COVID-19.
Yeah. You remember you and I actually had a text conversation about this, because I was shocked to see that they could override the special session. I am familiar with the state legislatures for a number of states, and I've never seen that. So yeah, that was a very interesting kind of insider baseball type thing of, yes, people wanted to address COVID, but no, the governor didn't want them stepping on her toes and her pen, so to speak, when they came to do that. And so, yeah, it's really interesting. I think the present issue is one Ziegler has been writing about. He actually has, I think, written two pieces that appeared in both Alabama Today and Yellowhammer this week on what's going on with the prisons, and did Biden's executive order, which it looks like it didn't, did that impact Alabama? But I think, again, all of these things that the governor has done is just making her more of a target for conservatives who want to rein back that executive power.
Yet the governor remains very popular, at least among Republicans. I don't know, maybe it's just still lagging the residual effect from remembering past governors that have left office in disgrace or whatever it might be. But, you know, whatever it's been thrown at her, and this goes all the way back to the gas tax She's taking a few hits. Obviously not as popular as she was when she first got into office, but she's still in that top echelon of governors around the country, viewed favorably by her constituents.
You know, I haven't seen anything new after the mask mandate. And have you seen anything new after the mask mandate? I feel like I've seen and heard more from the grassroots level, people a little bit more disgruntled about that than they have been about anything she did.
Well, I tell you what's interesting about that, and that's a great point. The state's evenly split, as they would say, a little more than 50% look at her favorably. I think this was an AUM poll. Maybe my memory is not right. But anyway, 50% or a little more than 50% look at her favorably for the way she's handled it. The other half is split evenly almost. Half of that crowd that is in disfavor with the as going too far. So it's like both sides of it, and then the other half of it overall thinks she's doing a good job. So there is some disapproval of the way she's handling it, but it's not for the same reasons.
Yeah, well, and you're right, liberals are like more quicker lockdown, longer lockdown, blah blah blah. Republicans are like, get rid of these dang mask mandates. The lieutenant governor got quiet awful fast. He had been on a tear about those things, but I think he said his piece. He knows, everybody knows where he stands, but I haven't really seen any pushback from conservatives that you'd usually see or hear from. And I say usually, I mean, during this COVID situation, it seems like everybody's just kind of letting her do her thing.
Well, Lieutenant Governor Ainsworth, he got COVID, and I think that kind of changed things from where he was coming from. But,
That's a fair point.
Yeah, but there's some members of the legislature. The usual culprits, I guess, are the ones they're speaking out. But you're right; it has really you don't hear the outcry like you had early on.
Well, and I wonder how much the establishment press is going to press legislators who are anti-Ivy on what would you have done differently, what would you have done better. Because I don't think there's a lot of Republicans in the legislature that have solutions besides, no, I didn't want the mask mandated, or, you know, I think that everybody is going to step away from that. I don't know how many people are going to come to Mike and say, okay, I had this great plan on what we were going to do with PPE and when we were going to close down and how we were going to open back up. I don't know anybody in the legislature that was taking that stance openly and consistently throughout the whole thing.
Well, I tell you, we got to wrap it up on this. There is kind of a COVID caucus. All these legislators have come down with it. And I wonder if that's really changed the way they view some of these restrictions or mandates or whatever you want to call them. Hey, April, we're about out of time here. Folks want to find you on social media, or they want to check Alabama Today out. Tell where to go.
You can find me on altoday.com. That's Alabama Today. And you can also find me on Facebook, Twitter, Parlor when it's back up.
Jack Daniels whiskey at 1.5 is how the folks around here have been living their lives.
Welcome back to the Jeff Porch Show on FM Talk 106.5. Thank you very much for listening. Always appreciate it. Happy Friday morning to you. Still to come on the program, Chris Elliott, State Senator from Daphne, joins us in the next segment. So please stick around for that. Also going to make some time here in the 11 o'clock hour for some of your texts and phone calls. So please keep them coming, 251-343-0106. Sean in Baldwin County writes, just saw a tweet. Doug Jones, and he makes his debut on CNN today as a political commentator. I tell you, Sean, I know a lot of you out there are kind of sour on Doug Jones. I whatever you want to think of him, he is a Democrat. He's voting as a Democrat. And I think he had a very honorable approach to really what he was trying to do, even though he's, might be wrong on a lot of things. I think he meant the best for the state. But, I've been trying to get him back on here to come on and some talk about some stuff, but I was really kind of disappointed that he didn't get that DOJ, Attorney General appointment. But I tell you what, guys, these cabinet appointments, they're, a lot of times very short-lived. I still think Doug Jones could eventually be working in the Biden administration in some capacity before these 4 years are up, whether you like that or not. But I can't see him being any worse than, and knock on wood here, but any worse than some of the other names that were mentioned very early on for the Attorney General post. And I also think he's a guy that would probably be confirmed by the Senate, but it still could happen. But joining CNN today, we wish him the best. Still a lot to talk about here. Underway right now, another COVID-19 briefing from the Biden White House. They're doing it live stream. There's a lot of mutations out there. They're coming up all over the country, that are maybe resistant to the vaccine. We don't know. There's so many unknowns about COVID-19, and it has to make you wonder that all of these measures were put in place. Are they effective? Are they really stopping the spread? Well, as far as I can tell, if you have a new strain being that are evolving, then maybe not so much. And if it gets really out of hand, what could come next? They're already talking about some other things, double masking. Where you have to wear two masks. Maybe they need to make more N95 masks. I don't know what that is, but the elections have consequences, and I think one of the consequences of the Biden administration is going to be a more of a willingness to use the power of the federal government to enact policies that don't really take into account some of the constitutional protections, or at least have a deference to freedom and free choice and personal responsibility. That you're not capable of that. The public's not capable of that. We got to rein in some of this. It's for your own good. It's in the name of public safety. So we're going to have to, make you wear more than one mask, or we're going to shut down some things. Public can't be involved. And then we see how that works out. When you shut down public forums, public buildings, you're still paying the same amount of taxes, or so it seems most of us are, but you still have the same liabilities that you had in the past, same duties, responsibilities you had to when it comes to government. But we're not going to let you participate in the process as much because COVID. So you see where I could go and see how that could be problematic. And when Democrats are in charge, and they are right now, that is, I think that is where government is going to really be a bigger part of the plan, a bigger part of the equation. And you know how that makes us feel as conservatives. We tend to cringe at that idea. We got to get a break in here. We will return. This is the Jeff Porch Show on FM Talk 106.5.
Gone with the wind. There ain't nobody looking back again.
Welcome back to the Jeff Porch Show on FM Talk 106.5. Thank you very much for listening. Still a lot to come on the program today. Clay Schofield, the Senate Majority Leader Designate, will be with us here shortly and a lot more, so stick around for that. But joining us now, always a pleasure, our usual Friday guest, one of Schofield's colleagues here, State Senator Chris Elliott, here for his weekly appearance. Senator, how are you this morning?
Doing great. Been a busy week in Montgomery to start with, and more to come.
Well, let's get right into that budget hearings this week. Did we learn anything? Anything that we need to be anticipating in the coming weeks?
A lot of good information as usual. I think one of the things that was most interesting that I saw was how well the live streaming portion of it worked out. So even members that were there didn't feel like they necessarily needed to be in the room and were able to watch it from their offices or other places. So I think, just testing that out and seeing how that was going to work is going pretty well. The budgets are in the revenue side of things is in reasonable shape. It's not gangbusters, but it's certainly not as bad as it could have been. And you know, with COVID and the slowdown, so I think things are good. And then just a flurry of activity, Jeff, with pre-filed bills. When I left, there were over 105 pre-filed bills in the Senate alone. So I expect a very active start to the session, and folks getting off to the races pretty soon.
Well, one of the dust-ups this week dealt with the prison situation. Jeff Dunn, Cam Ward, there at the budget hearings. We don't really have any details yet about which way or how that is going to go, but all indications are that Governor Ivey's going to release some details to some kind of lease build program. Do we know anything more than we have known, I guess, prior to these activities?
No, and the administration seems perfectly willing to simply say, we're not telling you, and it is becoming increasingly hard for myself and my colleagues to simply accept that we are to appropriate, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars and have no details on it. And you saw that in an exchange between Representative Moody and Commissioner Dunn earlier this week. I mean, the frustration level is palpable there. And then you've got the frustration Representative Hall brought up that you're seeing from the county commissions and the sheriffs, who are housing now more than 4,000 state inmates at county jails. And there just seems to be no willingness to acknowledge that those are state inmates, that they need to be transferred, that there is a significant cost to the counties for doing that. I just have never seen anything like it before, with a state agency like that just basically telling the legislature, you know, you can't make me, and I'm not going to tell you. And that is really the message that's coming out of there.
Well, it's hard to see where you could really – where there's any leverage you guys in the legislative branch have. And I assume a lot of your colleagues are just willing to go along with things, right, for now, that we've tried this in the past. And you young guys, you guys have only been here for this quadrennium. You don't remember the wars we fought. This is the best way to proceed, and that seems to be the prevailing sentiment.
It does, and you are correct about that. And it is a complicated problem, and it is a tough issue. And my concern is that this fix may not be a fiscally responsible one, but I don't know that because you don't have any of the details. It could be, but it could also not be. It's just that it is happening in a vacuum. And then, of course, when you really look at the numbers, you see an additional problem, and that is that we still may be in running a deficit when it comes to the number of beds we have. And we may not be fixing the problem, even though we're throwing a lot of money at it. And I'm just not sure that's the right way to go. But the administration and Department of Corrections are certainly not providing any details or data to let us digest to get any level of comfort with the path they're headed down right now.
Is the justification still this? Is it that we can't tell you the details because we're still negotiating the contract, and if we start telling you things, well, that can upset the negotiations? I mean, how much longer will that excuse be allowed?
Well, you know, that is what we are hearing. But you have to wonder if you're not sharing the details of a deal like this, is it because it's some sort of negotiating tactic? Is it because the details aren't any good? Is it because it's an incredibly expensive plan that will not be a good use of taxpayers' funds? You know, you have to wonder about why all the secrecy? If it's a good plan and it's a good deal for the state and for taxpayers, wouldn't you want to be talking about it? I just don't understand why the secret. The justification seems to be it's a competitive negotiation, but I am reminded of the Shakespeare line, she does protest too much, we think. You got to wonder, are we hiding just because it's that the details are not good.
Well, I'm going to speculate there. I mean, maybe there's still shell shock from the Bayway Toll Bridge experience. When this is tried in the media and on social media, the outcome is we have to abandon everything, and they don't want to have that same scenario. But the, I guess the problem would be if it happens like that this time, then do you run the risk of that being kind of a more of a precedent? And getting hard, politically tough things done, you just figure out a way to do it without. It's not even trying it in the legislature; so it's trying it in the court of public opinion.
Well, I would argue that that's a great comparison, but I would also argue that that's exactly what needs to happen. You know, we need to shine some light on it. There needs to be some transparency there. That what occurred with the Mobile River Bridge and Bayway project and the proposal by the administration was exactly what needed to happen. Once you got into the details, once we all were able to get into the negotiations, the proposals, the caveats that were going to be in the contract, everybody realized this is a bad deal, and it died, and it should have. And now you see a potential resurrection of something coming along that will be much better for the taxpayer, much better for the commuter, and all around better. And you have to wonder, yes, it may take longer. Yes, you may have to answer some questions. But is it the end result you get much better in the end, and really how you ought to govern?
Well, and we all know the saga here. The DOJ is on the verge of or has filed a lawsuit against the state. And there will be proceedings and all that. But I mean, I'm not sure how this is going to go, but just at face value, it seems very fragile that if it does finally make it into the court of public opinion, and it does have some question marks surrounding it, that it falls apart, wouldn't that just amp up the DOJ scrutiny even harder?
Well, and I understand that argument, but the DOJ's problems with our Department of Corrections is not just how many beds we have. And, oh, by the way, the proposal, the administration's proposal, the DOC's proposal, doesn't really fix that. It doesn't add a significant amount of beds when you start closing the other facilities. DOJ's problem with our corrections are institutional problems. They're management problems. Their conduct problems within the prison. It's not just bed space. So I think even if this sails through, I don't think it will, even if it sails through and all these prisons are built, all of those underlying issues that DOJ has with our prison system that they are threatening, that they are currently suing us over, those don't go away. The administration's proposal here is not a panacea and is not going to fix the lion's share of the problems that we are facing at DOC. That's got to be a management change in order to fix that problem.
But as far as what that's going to take, you said management change. I mean, is that a new commissioner, or is there some legislative steps that can be taken? I mean, we've been talking about this problem for 2 years, it seems now, and it's finally hit the fan. And now something's got to be done. Granted, COVID got to upset things in 2020. You weren't able to get anything done. But all during 2019, Governor Ivey laid it out in her inaugural address there in early 2019. I remember it was prisons and infrastructure. Infrastructure got checked off the list right away. Prisons still outstanding as we stand here today.
These are tough, complicated issues, no doubt. The problem is there are an awful, awful lot of them, and it would be a lot for any single manager to handle. I know others of my colleagues have called for a management change at DOC. I'm not sure that we have to do that. I'm frustrated. I'm frustrated with the lack of answers. I'm frustrated with the answer to counties that we just simply are just not going to take our responsibility for our inmates. I think that's completely unacceptable. But there are literally dozens of huge problems at DOC, all of which have to be dealt with and changed. It is a Herculean task, and we got to go through it bit by bit in order to get it changed. but we're going to have to start seeing some significant progress for the risk of the DOJ, you know, taking over is very real, and it won't be changed simply by building new privately owned prisons.
Joined by State Senator Chris Elliott here on the program. Let's move on to what should be a somewhat happier or more optimistic forward-looking topic, gaming in Alabama. We had Del Marsh on earlier in the week, or actually last week, and he says he's got a proposal for gaming. It's a comprehensive package. As far as once you get in those first 2 weeks, and let's say you get all the three big things with limit the liability protection, the taxation taken care of, economic development, and you get some work done, progress on the budgets, whatever that might be, then we start talking about these other big ticket items. And gaming, always about this time of year, right before we go into the official start of the new legislative year, will Alabama or won't Alabama get a lottery done this year? It's been the last 20 years or so. Any reason for us to be optimistic?
I think that there is broad support for a lottery. I think that getting there is going to be tough, because everybody that I talk to from a colleague standpoint seems to have some caveat about what has to be in the bill or what can't be in the bill in order for it to move. And it just seems very difficult to get all of those folks on the same page. I am in favor of a lottery. I voted for a lottery before. I'll vote for one again, or more specifically for, you know, to put an amendment on the ballot so that people can vote for it. But I am just concerned that there are a lot of my colleagues that have caveats that are just going to be hard to satisfy everybody, and especially in the House. You know, the Senate has passed it time and time again in one form or another, and it has just not seen action in the House. And I'm curious to see what the House does with it this time.
Yeah, and the Senate's been where, you know, you haven't had the typically in the last couple of years, you haven't had to tie up. And the Senate's where bills would go die. But here lately, it's been the House. Just, I guess, the divisions, the contrast are a little more stark than they are in the Senate. But you guys also, and it's not just a political affiliation or partisan thing, but you're able to get a lot of Democrats to come on board with you guys in the Senate, it seems, more so than the House.
That's true, and the working relationship between the different sides of the aisle in the Senate is very different than the dynamic that the House has. You know, we work very closely with our Democratic colleagues in the Senate. It's very congenial. Again, the House is different. And when it comes to gaming in particular, the divisions within the caucus in the House are different as well, and more pronounced on the issue of gaming. So I don't mean to not give you hope on that. I just am, and I am and remain hopeful, but I certainly have my doubts of this fact. To be successful.
I guess it's just folks are looking for a reason to be optimistic, and perhaps, you know, we always talk about it, but it does seem to, at least if anything, the different sides on that issue are closer than they've ever been before in the last 10 years or so.
I think that's a fair point, and I also think with Senator Marsh leading and championing this issue, and frankly having the time to devote to it, it stands a better chance than it has in the recent past of actually moving forward.
Senator, we're out of time. We got to leave it there, but I appreciate you making time for us and look forward to do it again next week.
Absolutely. Have a great weekend. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. State Senator Chris Elliott, ladies and gentlemen. We got to get another break in here. We'll be right back. This is the Jeff Porsche Show on FM Talk 1065.
When he's lying there instead of getting out of bed and putting on his boots and getting gone, what you gonna do when he says, honey, I got a half a mind to stay? What
what you gonna do with a cowboy when he don't saddle up and ride away?
Hello, Kansas, Wheatfield farmer, let me thank you for your time. You work a 40-hour week for a living, just to send it on down the line. Hello, West Virginia.
Welcome back to the Jeff Porch Show on FM Talk 106.5. Thank you very much for listening 55 minutes after the hour on this Friday morning. A little news for you here. This is just from the governor's office. Dateline Montgomery. Governor Ivey, Kay Ivey, and the Alabama Department of Public Health announced Friday, starting on February the 8th, the ADPH will extend eligibility for COVID-19 vaccinations to include people 65 or older and additional groups of frontline workers. You can go check out the Alabama Department of Public Health website, alabamapublichealth.gov, to go check out the vaccination or vaccine allocation plan. But according to this release, frontline critical workers that are included in the plan are first responders, corrections officers, food and ag workers, postal service workers, manufacturing workers, grocery store workers, public transit workers, people who work in the education sector, teacher support staff, community college and higher education, child care workers, and members of the judiciary, which include circuit judges, and district attorneys. So they're dropping that down from 75 to 65, the age requirement. The release quotes of Governor Ivey saying, "We have been frustrated that the supply of vaccine coming from the federal government hasn't kept up with demand. To be blunt, we simply haven't gotten the vaccine that we've been promised, and this has created a major backlog of aggravation. Today's announcement will ensure that as more vaccine is released, we will have a plan in place to get the vaccine in people's arms more quickly." Dr. Scott Harris also quoted, "Alabama is expanding its guidance despite the limited vaccine in order to accelerate the vaccine uptake in our state. I want to reiterate that any remaining vaccines that have not been administered are either someone else's first dose or they're waiting on their appointment or they are waiting on their second dose. Any vaccine currently in the state has someone's name on it." And finally, it adds, "As a courtesy to others, healthier people age 65 and older and workers who fall in these groups are encouraged to consider delaying their vaccination so that more vulnerable people can access the vaccine ahead of them." So maybe that's what we were looking for with the announcement there. Should the vaccine age requirement, should it be more readily available? And it is in some other states. There's a problem there. And here's the question we need to be asking. How do we get the vaccine back to how do we get the federal government to live up to its end of the deal and get doses our way? And really, what is the – I've heard mixed messages on this, and this might be a question I need to pose to the Alabama Department of Public Health. But Dr. Harris says that the distribution of the vaccine and number of doses administered does not impact the number of doses allocated to the state. And that if we somehow fall behind on administering the vaccine, then we're not going to be penalized by the CDC for not getting more vaccine out. But I've heard it both ways. I've heard it that, no, it's actually if you're not using your vaccine and the CDC sees that, well, they're not going to waste doses of the vaccine on a state that can't get its act together. They're going to look elsewhere for other places. So looking for a little clarity on that, where we'll put in a call to somebody. Maybe they can answer that question. Got to get a break in here. 251-343-0106 wide open the next two segments. If you want to weigh in on anything, please do. This is the Jeff Porch Show on FM Talk 106.5.
Not knowing where I'm bound, and no one can change my mind, but mama tried.
From Buck's Pocket to the shores of Orange Beach and all points in between, an insider's perspective on Alabama politics. It's the Jeff Poor Show.
I don't think Hank done it this way. No.
Welcome back to the Jeff Poor Show. Hour number three underway. Thank you very much for listening here on FM Talk 106.5. still to come. Clay Schofield, he will be the beginning February 2nd after they voted. It's all finalized. He will be the new state Senate majority leader. He'll be joining us at the bottom of the hour. Stick around for that. 251-343-0106. Let's talk about GameStop. Still the story. It's such an interesting thing. And you look, I don't think anybody's, there's been a few people, let's say, that have gotten rich off of the whole, saga with GameStop. And it's a fascinating story. And it's, let's see, it's up today, up 80%. Well, that's 182 points, or 182, yeah, today. And I bought $100 worth yesterday, full disclosure here, not as an effort to make any money, but I think it's an important balance. Wall Street's complicated. Investing is complicated. And it's not for the layman. I get everything that the so-called experts are telling us, how to proceed with our money and to be careful with it. But there's no question about it. There are people that have gamed the system. I don't think the system is necessarily rigged, but I do think it has been gamed in a way that's not fair to the retail investor, to the average person, to the person that puts money in their 401k. There's all of these ways to use technology to accelerate your trades that you and I don't have access to. But the short selling thing, to put on all this, to get over leveraged, go so short on GameStop. You know what GameStop is? It's a kind of a retail outlet, a storefront where you could go buy video games, video game consoles. I've maybe been in there like five times in my life, and ever since its inception. But they were trying to run down the price of this stock so they could sell it, or they could short sell it. And so essentially what that is, if you don't understand, you have a set number of shares that you borrow from somebody, and you wait for that stock to go low, and then you buy it back at a cheaper price, and that is your whatever you're able to get there is your profit. So I have 100 shares, and you borrow from me, and the price is, let's say, $100, and then that price falls. It falls to $20, and you go and buy a bunch of shares back at $20 each. Well, you're making that $80 per share or whatever. That's your profit, and it goes on. It's a way to add balance to the market. It has some virtues. Short selling is just part of the market. It shouldn't be outlawed or illegal. But what had happened was, there were more short selling of this particular stock than there was stock. It's kind of a fascinating thing going on. And so somebody saw that and said, hey, buy this stock up. It drove the price up. And did these hedge funds, these big investment firms that were short on GameStop, they got caught in a short squeeze. They had to cover their shorts. And that caused the price to go up even more because the stock was in such high demand. So you have this pressure. You have it twofold. It's pressure from Reddit or whatever, and people just wanting to make a statement, and then people that actually have to cover that are of outstanding shares of the stock that they have to present before the price goes up even more and more and more. So you have all of this pressure on the stock. And I mean, if I kind of stumbled through that explanation, but why I think this is reasonable. First off, if you believe in a totally free market, if you believe in, freedom of what to do with your money, I don't buy this notion, and I hear it from all these Wall Street guys, that people should be able to use their money however they see fit. If you want to buy a dud of a stock, that's your choice. Life is full of choices. But you're hearing from the Andrew Ross Sorkins and a number of others that, you and I are too naive, too dumb, too simple to understand the world of high finance. We don't need to be putting our hard-earned money towards stock because we could lose money, and that's too much of a danger, a personal danger to us. Therefore, leave it to the pros, leave it to the elites. That's the wrong message, but that is kind of the counter to what's going on here. But let's say Reddit, AMC, any of these stocks, American Airlines or whatever it is that they're talking about that are in danger of being shorted, you can't do this anymore. You can't get over your head on a stock if you're into this options trading. You can't go too far down that path and not think something like this will happen again. So this will be it might be the last resort. It might be that last line of protection. But it'll keep these big funds and these big hedge funds from going overboard and shorting a stock. Think of it as a check and a sort of on the system. So when you hear these guys that have figured out they're trying to just make money and they're going to go on TV or they're going to go on the airwaves and talk down a company to drive its stock price down, and then they're going to come in and buy it when it's really, really low and buy the dip there, and the fundamentals of the company may suggest something a little bit different than what they're telling you. And Tucker Carlson, he did this yesterday with Hilton Hotels. Use that as an example. He had a hedge fund manager go on CNBC or wherever and talk about how COVID was going to be the end of Hilton Hotels. It was going to drive that stock price down to zero. And if people see that, they start selling their shares of Hilton. Then he comes in and buys them all up at a discount. The COVID looks like it's going to still a threat, but it's not going to be as bad. The stock starts to recover, and he's making money off of it. I mean, you see the game there. Well, now that's the type of thing that goes on, and if they're trying to use the process of short selling to make money, you can't do that anymore without knowing that this kind of GameStop revolt from retail investors is not going to happen. That might make you think twice about engaging in these practices. I fully anticipate Congress and the people with the voices on K Street, the ability to navigate the SEC, are going to try to figure out a way to make it more difficult for this to ever happen again. And I would discourage people, I would discourage policymakers from going down that path. But I think it's a good thing. It's a net good thing. Some people are going to lose some money on this. Particularly yours truly, but it's a good thing to have that mechanism in place to keep these big funds a little bit honest when it comes to their practices. And, you know, you can't just expect government to do it. Let the market do it. And if there's money for somebody to be made by capitalizing on irresponsible, I would think irresponsible practices, then so be it. Let that be a lesson to you, traders, that if you're going to talk down a stock and you're going to short sell and you think you're going to make a bunch of money, not anymore. You're not going to be able to do that. The problem, though, are these little trading apps. And I've been using one called Stash, but the one in the news, really Robinhood, where they delisted. You couldn't even buy the stock for a while, and as that has raised some serious questions. And I think that's going to be something those guys at Robinhood are going to have to answer for. You could sell it, but you couldn't buy it, so they didn't halt trading, but technically you couldn't buy a particular stock. And the whole thing about this Robinhood app, it was supposed to be the proliferation of the retail investor. You're supposed to be able to go out and, you know, it was put the power into people, you know, all these platitudes we hear from corporate America, and it turned out to be just a talking point, a marketing gimmick. And a lot of that is what this is. But this is really, I think, a fascinating thing. All these years, since the 2008 crisis, maybe even before that, going back to the dot-coms, we were always looking for government to enact some kind of solution to curb those Wall Street fat cats and make them more honest. And then a lot of us out in the hinterlands would say, no, 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 free markets work. Let capitalism work the way it's supposed to. Free markets work. If everything's honest, then that's the best way. Government barely gets anything right. And then fast forward to this moment where the market's capitalizing on irresponsible behavior. And that has to be, I think, something that's much better, a much better approach than, say, Barney Frank and Chris Dodd sitting in a room somewhere thinking of a new bill that's going to stop these hedge funds from doing what they do. You get private citizens involved, and they capitalize on bad behavior. Well, then they're going to, like I said, these big funds are going to think twice about ever doing this again, aren't they? Because they got to protect their investors. And then that's kind of a good story, I think. And I hopefully this becomes more of a thing where, you know, if you see a big hedge fund getting way too out ahead and way too, our number of funds altogether, way too short on a stock, more than they should be, and they just continue to talk it down, then somebody will say, hey, they must be really, really, they must be really going on a short here. Let's make some money off of them and make them cover their shorts and force that price back up. Inevitably, maybe that's not the true intention of our market system, our financial markets, that these stocks and these vehicles, they ought to be traded based on the value of the company or what you think it is and what their profit potential is and how solid of a company they are. But if you're going to make it a game and you're going to make it that kind of a game, that's got to have consequences too. And it can't come at the behest of the government, because the government you just can't trust. Let the markets do it. And this is the best market approach I've seen, I think, in my time paying attention to these things. But Wall Street, not happy, and you'd expect it. It's just so disingenuous to hear, oh, well, you guys out there buying these stocks, you don't know what you're doing. You don't need to be doing this sort of thing. Let us handle it. Let us pros handle it. When you hear that, that ought to make a red flag go up. But the stocks trade about 80% up today, 153 points. Let's go through the text line here. Matt writes, it's about time the Wall Street fat cats knew the struggle of trading in games and consoles for little to nothing. Let's see. What else we got here? We got a few left over from Simpson. Jason writes, so we're taking down Raphael Sims in the middle of the night and putting up statues of ball players? Question mark. Let me ask you this, guys, Jason in particular. Would you be opposed to that? I'm disappointed that the Raphael Sims statue came down in the first place. I think it was a caving to the mob. I understand the reasoning. And I'm skeptical that it'll ever get back up. But I think I'd be okay with a Hank Aaron statue there. And he's as mobile as it gets. And I'm not preaching to you the diversity or any of that stuff. I think he's a big hero, a big part of Alabama history, an iconic part of the state. I don't know that I'd be necessarily opposed to having a statue of Hank Aaron there in its place. And Raphael Sims, as long as it was somewhere else where the public could see it, that'd be fine with me. Interested to hear from you. 251-343-0106. We got to get a break in here. We'll be right back. This is FM Talk on 106.5. Down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico. Hear Richard Best picking on that red guitar. So gather round, now gather round, chill and be down. Well, just get down, chill and get loud. Well, you can be loud, yeah, and be proud. And you can be proud, yeah, and I'll be proud. Well, yeah, because South's gonna do it again and again. Welcome back to the Jeff Moore Show at FM Talk 106.5. 24 minutes after the hour. Some big news here just breaking from our friend Todd Stacey at Alabama Daily News. Ivy to sign a prison deal. Dateline Montgomery, Alabama. Governor Ivy is set to sign lease agreements for two men's Alabama prisons parts, part of a long negotiated plan to overhaul Alabama's dilapidated corrections infrastructure. He goes on to write. On a call with state lawmakers Friday, Department of Corrections Commissioner Jeff Dunn said Ivy would soon sign the contracts for CoreCivic, one of the developers bidding, and follows up and says Ivy Press Secretary Gina Miola said the contracts are scheduled to be signed on a Monday. How about that? But here you read down, and this is behind a paywall, so hopefully I'm not giving too much away here. Ivy on Thursday told ADN she does not plan to show lawmakers the lease agreements before she signs them, and her office of the administration has shared as much information on the ongoing negotiations as possible without disclosing sensitive details that could threaten the deal. How much more are we going to hide behind that? I don't like this at all. I don't like that the governor is able to operate under the cloak of secrecy and sign a deal and use the excuse that there's sensitive details that would threaten the deal. We all we really have as far as details, it's very, very thin. If this were $1 million or a one-time thing, but this is $88 million a year for 30 years or something like that. And in addition to that, some of these prisons, at least the third one is opposed in Bibb County. That one faces some roadblocks, but two of these, at least one very publicly, people, when they want to build the prisons in Elmore County, do not want it there. If you don't know Elmore County, Alabama, it's just north of Montgomery. It's on the north side of the Alabama River. It's where the Coosa and the Tallapoosa come together to form the Alabama River. Wetumpka is where it is, and there's a bunch of prisons scattered throughout around Wetumpka. Well, that is in what you would call the western part of the county. They can't find land in the western part of the county to build these facilities, and so they're building them in the eastern part of the county where there's never been a history of prisons. The western part of the county, yes, there has been a history there. But in the eastern part, no. But that's where they want to put them, around Tallahassee. It's closer to Auburn, if you're familiar with the area. And the people there don't want it. And they didn't get a public hearing about this. All they could do is go to their member of the Alabama legislature, which is Will Barfoot in the Alabama Senate. And what the legislature hasn't been in session since May. So this is controversial. It'll be interesting to see how the governor and the legislature navigate this. It's really coming on Monday, and then the legislature becomes on Tuesday when they convene and become when they're in. They're really working against the clock here to get this deal signed before the Alabama legislature gavels in and could upset the deal. Look, I have no doubt that Ivy, Joe Bonner, all those guys, they probably have the best of intentions. They just got to get the deal done to get it done. But we can't have that kind of a system, right? That's not really how our system should operate, where, for the sake of the ends justify the means, and the means in this way are not necessarily as democratic as they could be. Because if anything goes wrong, well, you didn't go through the due processes of, talking about it, deliberating, finding the right facility, talking about funding mechanisms, and all of that a sound plan, because this is not just a one-off. This is a multi-decade thing, and the Department of Justice is really looking at Alabama and its handling of this. If they see something upset or something wrong with this, they're still going to proceed with their lawsuit, and it could be punitive. If a judge sees it or however it proceeds civilly, it could be at a big, big expense to the taxpayer. All right, guys, we got to get another break in. We'll be right back with State Senate Majority Leader Designate Clay Schofield. So stick around. This is the Jeff Porch Show on FM Talk 106.5. There's always a stage and a beautiful band.